Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
All because the focus of your show tonight is what makes boys kill their mothers. But so far, your guests haven't given us any insight into that.
Get that whore out of my house.
She's not a whore, Mother.
I said get rid of her. Or do I have to do it myself?
No, Mother.
Cry, whore!
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 276, Psycho 4, The Beginning. Now, made-for-TV movies have provided excellent fodder for the podcast. I'm looking at you, Snowbeast, with the lumbering title Snowbeast, as well as Bo Svenson. A terrifically awful, hilarious movie that I didn't know existed, and nor did I know this one existed, because while I'm a fan of some of the Psycho sequels, I think they're hilarious and ridiculous, this one is kind of a smart, dare I say, departure from those kind of sleazier efforts.
Okay, fair enough. Well, yeah, we'll get into our differing opinions and maybe what our converging opinions as well in a moment or two. But I knew this existed. How I knew it existed was it was on the shelf of that podunk video store I worked at when I was when I went on my massive now horror fan. Let's watch everything that's out there,
and probably permanently on that shelf. Because who would want that?
Well, it is, yes, permanently. And ironically, not ironically, we just use that word way too much.
Yeah,
those transitions. Well, I mean, weirdly, let's say.
Parenthetically, you could say
we had the weirdest selection. Like we would only have one of a series. So if somebody wanted to, let's say, gorge themselves on the Godfather saga, we'd be like, oh, we got part two. That's all we got. And when it came to Psycho, all we had was Psycho 4, The Beginning. So it's good we had The Beginning, although, well, we didn't really have to be. We didn't have Psycho. We didn't have Psycho 2. We didn't have Psycho 3. Those movies I had seen anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Now, I love all three. Psycho 1, Psycho 2, Psycho 3. For different reasons. I think Psycho 2 is one of the best sequels, especially to a movie of that magnitude.
Agreed.
I don't think, you know, we did a podcast on Psycho 2 and we were saying this movie had no right being even made, let alone to be as good as this. That came out, it did really, really well, working off a Cracker Jack, Tom Holland script, what have you. And then Psycho 3 came out, I believe, in 83, and I liked it, but this one was lurid. They took the sex and violence to a previously unseen level in this series, but it was fun.
Anthony Perkins directed it.
It was chock-a-block full of nudity. There was a terrific kill that was, I think, a throwback to the shower scene, except in a phone booth, which was just dynamic and exciting and cool.
To this film's credit, this is really the only Psycho affiliated property that made no throwback to the shower scene whatsoever. There's a lot of other throwbacks, too many if you
ask me.
There's
a sink with blood going down.
But right,
I was going to make sort of a bold claim at the outset of the podcast, and I wasn't sure whether I should.
Chucky soup can be eaten like a meal.
Miller Lite is both tastes great and is less filling. Now, I was going to say, like, for sequels that discount what happened in the interceding time period, like this one does. It's like a direct sequel to the first one. I would say that this is better than Halloween 2018.
Well, you know, it's amazing. Bam. I was going to bring that up, actually, because...
Who would have thought?
It was going in my head just as you were speaking, because last year was the 40th anniversary of Halloween. So we were treated to a new installment.
And by treated, you mean no, we weren't subjected to?
Not metaphorically nor literally.
It's true.
But there was a 40th year installment, which also discounted what had come in the ensuing 40 years. This one was 30 years hence, so about a decade less than Halloween. Now, were people asking for this movie? Were people clamoring for this movie?
Not at all.
I don't think so. I mean, this 1990, this thing was made. It was, we can't really say it's a made-for-TV movie, because that I sort of reserved for network TV. This was made for Showtime. So sort of like a made-for-cable movie.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was going to take the Norman Bates saga, sort of discount what happened in 2 and 3, and just sort of be a direct sequel to Part 1. And in many ways, not only is it a direct sequel to Part 1, but in many ways, it's Part 1. Because what it does, and this is unfortunate, this film is not without credits. There are some things that are really cool, but there's a lot of debits. And unfortunately, this being Psycho, the beginning, anytime you have the beginning in the title of a horror film, you know, you're going to be going back and finding out more about their origin and what made them tick and why they are the way they are and this and that. We knew all that from Psycho. See, because in Psycho, it was just masterful. I mean, what Alfred Hitchcock spent the majority of the film implying, telling, this one spent showing, you know? And like I said, implying. Like, we didn't need to know that there was this weird psychosexual relationship happening between Norman and Norma Bates, right?
Mm-hmm.
We knew it was happening.
Yeah.
So to see it, to see an older Henry Thomas, of course, from E.T., right? Growing up, tussling around with his mom, played again by the... I've mentioned so many times in this podcast, Olivia Hussey, because of...
Our mutual love of Black Christmas and whatever.
Well, Black...
And of her as well.
Well, I mean she's gorgeous. Well, you're going to say, mutual love only gave it 2.5 stars when we did a podcast on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, she's also a turkey shoot. She was also an ice cream man. And for me, she will always be Julietta. When we read Romeo and Juliet in grade 10, and it's always traditional after you read the play to watch whatever Zeffirelli film was made.
Yes.
And when he made his version of R&J, he put
Olivia Hussey. Is that what the kids are calling it?
That's what they're calling
Hashtag
it.
#R&J. That's the bard.
he casted Olivia Hussey, and she was only 15 at the time, and then she did some nudity, and we saw it as, we were actually 15 years old as we were watching this in grade 10. And all the guys in the class were just went,
oh, good
ape shit. And I mean, yeah, she's a beautiful girl, beautiful woman. She was a beautiful girl. Now she's a beautiful woman. And so when Norman Bates is rolling around in bed with her, practically naked, is she, I don't know, we just don't need to know he got a stiffy. I mean, it's not.
They really are delving into the psychosexual dynamics. I mean, this is, although they do touch on, I guess, the recidivism and the rehabilitation element from Part 2, which mm-hmm. I thought was neat.
Like I said, it's not all bad.
No, and that's what they maybe should have done with Halloween 2018, because you just have this mute killer in chains in that ridiculous chessboard scene that we both just lampooned no end. Feel free to check out our Halloween 2018 podcast. But mm-hmm. yeah, that was the most effective way to delve into that. Like, can someone be rehabilitated? Is someone doomed to live to the end of their existence based on one thing that mm-hmm. may be attributed to mental illness? It's what, you know,
but that's what
Cronenberg looked at with a history of violence.
And that's what they looked at in Psycho 2 to quite good effect.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
In this one, we have that. See, because this Norman Bates, I really don't even feel you needed to discount 2 and 3 to, you know, I mean, okay, it's years later, he's now a happily married man. He's married to a psychologist, psychotherapist.
Yeah, from the Sedonia Institute, where he was housed, which sounds like a kind of an odd way to meet. And, you know, not exactly speed dating or whatever, but it's like they were both, in this institution. It's her, like, voluntarily, yeah. Him not so much.
And it's the not sparks. As bad as Raising Kane. Do you remember that? Where they're making out at the deathbed of the
it's true.
The doctor, you know, and the husband of the woman who's about to die.
That broached propriety right there. Yeah. But that was not really delved into. But she's willing to give him another chance, maybe because she has daily experience seeing how he's progressed while he's confined to that facility. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But I think, that dynamic is really well done. Although this is really not about them. It's mostly about, it's like a coming-of-age tale of Norman.
Well, it's a coming-of-age tale of Norman. It's also a examination into matricide in a certain extent. And I thought that one element that you would really glom onto was the talk radio element, because you love talk radio, right?
Indeed. Eric Bogosian.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was going to say you love
talk. Oh, yeah, in small, you know.
I like, the movie's great, too. So let's talk about that. That's the framing device for this film.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned matricide, because one of the silly films that we were subjected to is Oedipus Rex with Christopher Plummer. It seems like every high school
I never saw that
in existence.
We read the play, but I don't recall
watching. They foisted these terrible productions on you to help you learn the material, which is like, you know, 2,500 years old, whatever it is. So see if it can be brought to life with this cornball Canadian production. So at least you got Franco Zeffirelli. I got this.
Was that straight off of Stratford?
Straight out of Stratford.
Straight out of Stratford.
That was funny.
Another so-and-so who's rocking the bar. I don't know. I can't do it.
But talk radio. I love that because, I used to stay up late and listen to these ridiculous conspiracy shows like...
Art Bell,
and these guys who who could twist anything into some ridiculous conspiracy. But this one has.
You must be listening to a lot of Alex Jones, obviously.
Well, funny you say that. Like, he's obviously retarded, but he's in some ways a genius for being able to pull something out of his ass based on anything. If you told him stoplights, he'd be going like, "Why are they like green, like for traffic?" The government wants you to get to work quicker. Like, he has some ridiculous explanation.
Everything is
related to something. He has off the charts ability to improvise. So,
and I will allow you the use of the term retarded. Because it's Alex Jones.
He is retarded, but he's in some if I could speak extemporaneously about anything like that, and obviously he's just full of crap. But this show features Fran Ambrose. A talk show host played by the excellent CCH Pounder.
CCH Pounder. What a great name. Growing up, I always called her Pounder.
They call CCH Pounder in France?
Oh my God. Because they have the metric system, right?
Kilogram? CCH Pounder with cheese. I don't know. Yeah, this is going nowhere. No, she's on NCIS New Orleans. She's
no
pretty great.
It's within her name. Within her,
no,
her name.
It's so infuriating, it's that name.
It's Pounder. But anyway, I knew... that no parent, no sane parent would name their child.
So it is shortened for something, and she has this kind
CCH.
Of... She speaks close to the microphone, a la Warriors, and she's a talk show host, and she has the most ridiculous... I mean, talk show hosts in the afternoon drive time or at night always have to fill up airtime with crap, because there's only so much you can talk about, whatever, the New York Yankees or whatever. So she has matricide as the topic.
Which does not seem to me to be the most typical rush hour...
drive time topic.
Drive time topic. I mean, that's something that, you know, you think would be reserved for like the
overnight.
Post-midnight. Yeah. Exactly. But like, you know, coming home from a Thursday evening, I wonder what... I wonder what
how together
is doing, and you're listening about matricide. It's like...
Yeah, it made no sense. And she's got this expert...
idiot talking heads that are reported to be experts about matricide, but what she does not have... is somebody who, well, I think at one, was there a killer at one point? She had, I don't know, I don't even remember, but.
I believe she had a killer on who was rehabilitated.
Yeah.
And then, but she got a caller's perspective.
She got a caller's perspective of what a caller she got. When you want to talk about matricide, she hit the mother load. She got, he wasn't claiming to be Norman Bates. He introduced himself as Ed, which is interesting because you got to think that must have been a callback to Ed Gein.
Ooh, good call.
Considering that, Psycho was influenced by the Ed Gein story,
indeed.
Of course, was TCM and a whole bunch of other movies. He gives his name as Ed, and he's like, "I'm going to talk to you guys about matricide. How did what? Well, what do you know about matricide? Well, I killed my mother. And
what's there to tell? Yeah, and he didn't exactly bury the lead there. And she, of course, wants to use him for ratings purposes. And when Dr. Richmond cuts him off and says, this guy's full of crap, he's just a prank caller, this and that, and she persists and says, no, no, he sounds legit, keeps him on the line. And over the course of, well, this is a weird narrative device, over the course of the film, essentially, his interactions with her provide whatever, you know, threadbare thrust of a narrative this film has. Really.
First of all, I see this a lot in movies. They even did this one on talk radio, where you get the caller who calls in, hangs up, come on, call us back, and they call back. And it's this back and forth, hang up, call back, and, you know, like, you've been very fortunate with radio stations getting through, winning.
I've called in to a talk radio show once.
Yeah?
Yeah. I don't know why.
I've never made it through the gatekeeper to busy signal, honestly, man. And I've tried many times. I tried to give my opinion. I've tried to win contests. I've tried to be the fifth caller. I've tried to what have you. I never get past that.
That's weird because growing up, I lived on a hilly part of town. And
that's why growing up we all called you the fool.
Oh, very good. Beatles. And for some reason, my radio picked up a Philadelphia radio station. And they had a movie show. Mm-hmm. And this guy would talk movies, and I listened to it every week. And I called in to talk about David Cronenberg. And I was probably 16. So it was kind of weird, but I mean...
We didn't call Chris a fool. We weren't that mean.
No. Well, it's not entirely untrue. But yeah, I was like, why... What is the appeal? I guess it's why people argue on Reddit.
What is the appeal?
But people on Reddit calling in to complain about some shit on the radio, it beggars belief. It's ridiculous. But this was a thing and continues to be a thing, although hopefully,
the internet has pretty much supplanted the radio.
And if we may be so bold, podcasts has supplanted radio. We like to think we've got, you know, maybe some people will, you know, forego the morning zoo, you know, with the slide whistles and just go for us instead. No,
well, that's
ads.
Great, but I'm going to take umbrage on that one, only because what a podcast lacks that radio has is real-time interaction with the listeners.
You know? True. About the public square, the talk of the town, the today's business, the sports news. So yeah, we can't. Although we could have people phone in and
do
a live show.
I would love to do that. I was thinking about it.
Live YouTube, live Facebook, whatever, Instagram.
Yeah, live YouTube. I don't want to lose half our audience once they see my ugly mug.
We do have faces for radio, getting back to radio, but I thought that was really cool, and she was a great character, and their interaction was great, but really a lot of this movie is flashback to...
And too much of it is that.
Yes, and I mean, I thought they got away with a shitload for being a made-for-TV movie. Now, you say made-for-cable, so you can always... You can get away with a lot more, as The Sopranos showed us and all that kind of stuff, but this was... I mean, my God, like sleeping in the same bed as Mother, all the kind of Freudian undertones really brought to the forefront when it was subtext in the original, and then the great reveal that Hitchcock gave us here. It was like, they're rolling around playfully, and then all of a sudden Normie's got a chubby, and it's like, oh, God, I did not see that one coming.
It's such a joke there.
I know.
It's like 10 jokes. My brain's about overloaded at this point.
That was pretty shocking, and I thought it was pretty ballsy.
Okay, but let's get serious for a moment, Chris.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we know that Norman Bates has mother issues. We've known this since 1960. When
This is the granddaddy of mummy issues movies. Yeah.
Exactly. But it's become such a trope of horror, you know, and you can't blame Psycho for that, before the granddaddy, the best there is, the best there was, the best there will be, so to speak. But because it's become such a cliche in so many inferior horror movies, I almost feel like this one took it to such an unneeded level of hyperbole, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I think could have used a lot more subtlety, you know, in terms of the interactions between... I mean, they were practically, you know, making googly eyes to each other the entire time that they were sharing a screen, you know, and lolling tongues or whatever the heck. I don't know.
It was very odd. But again, what more did they really have to go on? Because there's really no plot apart from it was very thinly developed relationship between the psychologist, Connie, I believe her name was, and Norman, who is really an afterthought in this movie. And perhaps because I think he died. I mean, Anthony Perkins died shortly thereafter.
Okay, because what I did know, this is what I think, is that he got his diagnosis while filming. So perhaps he might have died shortly thereafter. But he, when filming began, he was assumed he was healthy. And then he got his diagnosis in during the production process. So did that, was he feeling unwell? Was he looked to me fine. I don't know.
He did. I mean, you couldn't pick a more character-driven franchise in all of horror, save for maybe A Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, he makes the entire thing. And I would say this is one of the more...
Speaking of you, Vince Vaughn.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, yeah, that's funny. That should only come up now. But that movie, Accepted. This is one of the more underrated, I would say, franchises. Because, again, that Accepted, because it was shot-for-shot absolute turd that was unnecessary beyond belief. But I mean, these entries otherwise are pretty solid. It's not like the case of diminishing returns we've seen. I mean, hell, you mentioned Texas Chainsaw. There's some awful entries in that one.
Believe it or not, there was just,
the worst this gets is not that bad.
There was even a television series that went to, I think it didn't get much past pilot. Maybe there's two episodes max, or maybe just one made for TV movie, which was a backdoor pilot. There was that series Baseball Hotel that was on a number of years ago.
I never saw it.
This show, I believe, was also called Baseball Hotel, and it starred, now this is from memory, it could be wrong, but I did see it, I rented it. It starred Bud Cort from Harold and Maude.
Nice.
And I believe he played a relative of Norman, and he inherits a motel. And I remember the first episode, it was a 2-hour movie, but it was meant to be a pilot for a series. I remember Jason Bateman was in it, an early Jason Bateman. And it was meant to be a bit of an anthology series taking place in the motel. And Bud Cort was playing a pretty decent character. I mean, he wasn't like an evil guy or anything. He didn't inherit any of the psychological problems of his, I'm saying uncle, but I don't even remember right now. But yeah, so it's been quite the franchise for sure. And you're right, it has been relatively strong.
And that is, I don't want to say solely because of him, but I mean, in large part, like, he's a great character. Well, you can't go wrong. And
it's funny because Anthony Perkins is amazing. Every time you see him, in just about anything, he's great. Now, this film was directed by Mick Garris, who called Anthony Perkins, based upon the experience of this movie, the most difficult actor he's ever worked with. Now, is this because of the health problems that he was experiencing at the time? Is it because of getting this diagnosis, whatever? Maybe yes, maybe no, because I've heard other stories about Anthony Perkins that he was very, very fastidious in the way he wanted things to be.
I could see that. Maybe he was just method acting. His character is incredibly fastidious and incredibly neat. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has all the hallmarks of a control freak, neat freak. Who, I don't know, like, how did Mick Garris come to even be involved with this?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, this was made, I believe, right around the time when Mick Garris did, it was early in his career, and I think his biggest hit at this point was Critters 2.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
Like, this was before he did the Stand miniseries, this was before he did Sleepwalkers, which, by the way, did not do very well at all. It was a notorious flop, but it has become embraced.
Did he do a Shining made for TV as well?
He did the official Shining miniseries, and you know, the one that Stephen King actually gave his approval to. He did Riding the Bullet, which is another Stephen King adaptation. This is a man, Mick Garris, who has done more Stephen King adaptations than any other filmmaker in history.
And he's unmistakable. He's got that, he's got that long, long hair, you know, like Johnny Winter style hair, his flowing locks. But he's like, I'm familiar with his work. Critters 2, I've seen. Forgotten about, but I mean, everyone, critics included, say that he handled himself very capably here. I mean, is a movie that did not, I mean, not that it didn't deserve him, but he just acquits himself very well in this kind of schlocky material, mostly flashbacks.
No, think about it. I mean, look, he's a great guy, Mick Garris. We're Facebook friends. We interact every now and again. He has a podcast of his own, which I shall plug right now, although he does not need the plug because he gets guests like Joe Dante and Stephen King on his last two episodes. And
damn.
But it's the Postmortem podcast. And Mick Garris is a cool guy.
Well, we're confident enough in our, perhaps not, you know, masculinity, but maybe in our podcasting ability to be able to shout out any podcast we please. So yeah, I've heard that it's really good, and I will definitely check it out. And to his credit, he's been consistently working, and he keeps, I don't know, Stephen King has incredible faith in him, say what you will of that. And again, here, like Psycho 4, again, without knowing this existed, getting with a title that's really a nod to Friday the 13th Part 5 or whatever, I mean, I had no clue about where this was going, what it was up to, and...
Well, like I said before, the beginning really was Psycho. So, okay, it was, you know, post-priori, so to speak, in terms of, you know, the mother being dead already, but all of that wonderful... Chris, is it Freudian? Is it Jung? It's Freudian, right?
It is Freudian.
All that wonderful perversion, Freudian, sexual subtext, and so on. That was all there. It was all on screen in 1960. It was just implied, you know? And the audience inferred it quite readily, whereas with this one, just too many scenes of show. Showing what happened to Norman's dad. I don't think that was discussed in the original Psycho.
No, which is weird, but...
Showing the scene when Norma, the mother, finds out that the highway is not going to bisect the motel. Showing... A lot of interesting, like, this is another thing that they, again, might have implied in the original, but expression versus repression. Norma Bates is very sexual until it gets to a point, and then she becomes very puritanical. Norman was the recipient of all this. It's like she would tease him. She would take him to the point where, I mean, that one's mother and son. It's kind of, would show any sort of physiological response. Then he was humiliated. And he was told to dress up like a sissy, like a girl.
Yeah.
You know? And he was actually given a wig, and he was given...
No, we really didn't. And then it's almost like Rob Zombie's Halloween, and like we're given obsolescence, hyperbolic, if you will, as you said, backstory, which is really not... And very little of the kind of implied multiple personality that is more... Yeah, it was neither here nor there. They did too much of that backstory with him and the mom. It expressed itself through how he repressed his sexuality as a young teen when he's out on dates and he meets up with, you know, the Olivia Hussey character and he can't, and he's not knowing what to do, but even more so because he's conflicted by her pressure and he doesn't, like, he has, his sexuality is very odd and disturbed and twisted based on Norma's influence.
That's why I think, honestly, like, this thing ran for about 80, 90 minutes perhaps, and I really feel like there's a good 20-minute film in this movie, and the rest is just a ton of padding. As far as I'm concerned, present-day Norman is compelling, and he's betrothed, as we said before, and his wife is expecting. And when he calls into the show, he says, "I've killed before and I'm going to kill again." He's actually considering killing his wife. Why? Because he's afraid that the psycho gene or whatever is
heritable.
And he doesn't want any more innocent blood shed other than his wife, perhaps, by another... he wanted the base lineage end right there and then.
Oh, man. Well, you know, too bad ultrasound technology was not as well developed as it is today, because you could just determine whether it's a boy or a girl. And then presumably if it's a girl, you're far less likely to pass on these kind of psychopathic traits, right? I mean, we can count on one hand the number of psycho women, really. So, but that was also an interesting subplot, because he's torn about, bringing another, one of, you know, bring his genetic material into the world where it really shouldn't. And I thought that was interesting. They could have explored that to a much greater degree instead of this weird, awkward dating scenarios with him as a kid and then his odd thing with his mother and this ridiculous subplot about, again, the motel being bulldozed. It was less than the sum of its parts, but again, it was still so character driven that you couldn't help but be captivated whenever he was on screen. Swing and a miss on some levels, but I don't know, maybe they should have invested a little more. Like, I'm thinking, what was that, the hillbilly country singer? And was that in part 3 or part 2? I think it was part 3. who was staying at the motel. Yeah. And I thought that was an interesting, you know, vehicle to like run things around. So here you really didn't. You had sort of a disconnect between Norman and the people on the radio show. But and then that happening while flashbacks are happening. So there's no real
narrative thrust
yeah. because his relationship with Connie is not really much of a factor until the very end, where there's some ostensibly big cathartic twist that's supposed to happen, and Norman invites her to his mom to a dinner party
at
his mom's house, and you think okay, where is this going to go?
Well, actually, I thought the last few minutes were really cool, to be honest with you. I can't say much more of it because I don't want to spoil anything, but I thought it was cathartic, and I thought it was actually quite an interesting little storytelling device in terms of visualizing poor Norman's heavy conscience and everything. So yeah, and I liked it.
Is this the point of the show where we go to what we've learned?
Sure.
Because I learned that there's a certain multi-syllable word that Norman is known for that he uses. I don't know, his vocabulary, the size of his vocabulary.
Ordinately or inordinately?
Yeah. Dr. Richmond, this subject matter expert on this matricide drive time radio show, he is the author of, and this is hilarious, The Mother Killers. Which is a book title.
I used to think the matricide was when you cut off the tag off your mattress.
Oh my god!
I know, that's so bad. On right now, Chris.
Oh my god!
Give me a rim shot. Thank you.
What's your sleep number, Jeff? I don't know. Yeah.
What did you like to know, Chris? Oh god!
Pounder, I hardly knew her. But yeah, it's like, what did you learn?
A question. Many Bates, to be as such, many consider him not to fit into the criteria. Norman Bates, slasher, yay or nay? Would you say he's a slasher?
How does one define? You can't answer a question with a question. Rhetorically annoying. Mm-hmm. Screw you, Socrates. Okay, I'll say in part 2 and 3, he does amass a body count.
Exactly.
And there is a callback in this movie to the sinking of the car in the swamp.
Yep.
And yeah, I guess in Norman, it's been a while. Does he cut himself shaving and bleed into the sink with a little bit of blood? So it's a little bit of a callback. But I forget if it was that. It was something. There was something in a sink. So it was very rare. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I guess it is somewhat of a slasher.
Yeah, I mean, there's many, if you're going to go down the DSM of what makes someone a slasher, so to speak, right? I mean, he ticks a number of the boxes, doesn't tick a lot of the other boxes. But if we were to grant the fact that he is a slasher, and the sequel sort of did make him one, he has to be the most sympathetic slasher in cinema history. I mean, I don't think there's ever a time in any Psycho property, especially when you got Anthony Perkins playing him, where I don't feel the utmost sympathy for Norman Bates. And it's a number of factors. It's a sad backstory. It's that inherent loneliness that they're about him, that inherent awkwardness that he has, this sort of
awkwardness around women.
Although he was probably channeling it. So many women throwing at him, and it's the course of it. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah,
but no, most of it is just the performance of Tony Perkins. I mean, he inhabits that character like no other. Some people say that, the most indelible slasher actor might be Robert Englund, in the sense that nobody else could play Freddy Krueger, as was evidenced by that god-awful remake. because you've had many, many, many different stuntmen playing Freddy, many playing Jason. But because Norman Bates is unmasked, you can't just put some interchangeable stuntman underneath a mask and say this is, it doesn't matter if he's grown, if he's gained 100 pounds in the last film, like when Kane Otter took over. But no, Anthony Perkins, I mean, the guy inhabits his character. He owns his character. This character is his. And he is, it's a stutter. It's a little twitches he does. It's everything. And you just, from the moment you see him in Psycho 1960 up until this, which was his last turn in the role, you never feel like this man deserves his comeuppance. You feel bad for him. You want to take him in your arms and give him a hug. At least I did.
Yeah. And his relationship with his mother is so impactful, maybe because it's just so personal. Like, I feel the same way as I do about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre family. That there's something so... I mean, they do horror really well in a familial setting. There's no one else that can beat that. So for all the litany of movies that draw on mommy issues or daddy issues or family issues, these are the two movies that really exploit it to the greatest end.
Although with TCM, like, there's no real conflict in the family. They're all...
No, but that's what makes it almost worse when they... Especially the scene with the hammer with Grandpa, and they just take an average, ordinary setting, like at the dinner table, and they turn it into something so horrific. Although and they turn it on its head, the typical... What is supposed to be family get-together.
They do treat Bubba or whatever, you know, whatever name they gave him in whatever sequel, Leatherface, as you know, a bit of an outlier of the family.
He is. He's the black sheep. Speaking of sympathetic
characters.
That's what
makes him sympathetic. Yeah. And, Leatherface is sympathetic.
And both influenced by Ed Gein. So there's the common thread. But, I mean, there you can't, I mean, beat those in terms of familial, if you want to call it that, horror. But
I like Spider Baby as a good example of familial horror.
Horror, yeah, in the broadest sense.
Interpersonal family dynamics is such a tried and true storytelling device, in not just in horror, but in drama. You know what I mean? Basically, like John Lovitz when he played the actor. Remember that character?
Yes, yeah.
Drama!
Drama.
The actor. Acting. Norman Bates is the most sympathetic slasher ever. You know, this one, I mean, the maternal guilt was just taken to the most logical extreme. You know, I should have killed you. You almost killed me. Like, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Giving
in the
birth
room,
to you.
Yeah.
You know, and you see that up to Game of Thrones with, like, Tyrion Lannister, you know, where everyone hates him because he almost killed his mother and he's an imp and let's just get out of the way. The Game of Thrones season finale sucked and let's just move on. We won't talk much more about it. And the story. What else? What, did you learn anything else?
They took a little... you know, Victorian kind of route, Agatha Christie, with this poisoning subplot, which is quite hilarious. And as par for the course here, with the jealousy and the Oedipal complex and all that kind of thing, the mother's new lover, who supplants young Norman, and he decides to off the two of them. I guess he's just become just sick of this sexual and otherwise abuse at the hands of Norma, that he... fashions this concoction. I think it's strychnine, but I can't be too sure. Pours it into these goblets, and then that factors into the finale, although not to the uber meta finale that you were talking about before. But I thought that was pretty weird, and also it didn't really add much. I think it could have been better explored had he done that with his de facto stepfather maybe earlier in the film. It was kind of a throwaway, almost like a we need to have something more violent and impactful to add to the end. And it was just this seemingly out of nowhere, but kind of funny as well. Sort of a misplaced kind of horror, Hammer horror kind of element that didn't really sit right. But I don't know, it sat right enough. Like, I feel like I'm mentioning too many debits for as much as I kind of like this one. So I hope the balance hasn't tilted too much toward that side, because I hope to remedy that with my star rating, which is a solid 3. We said this about 2. We said this about 3, which we haven't podcasted, at least in our, I think we wrote up reviews on the site. It's been a while. But this has no business being as watchable as it is. Mm-hmm. There's no way. Garris obviously has a love for the source material. The Bernard Herrmann score features prominently here, of course.
First time it was actually used for one of the sequels, to be honest. Yeah.
And it goes to show how impactful that is to ratchet up scares. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you can't beat that.
Well, I'm not quite as enthusiastic as you. I'm going to give this one 2.5 stars, and the majority of that is for the final third, which I thought was crackerjack. I just felt that there was too much unnecessary padding, showing us things that we really didn't need to see, because we knew it already. It wasn't like there was this whole great mystery in Norman Bates' backstory, like, ooh, how did he become the way he did?
Well, I guess not. I mean, no, where else could they have gone?
Is there anything else? I mean, other than like how his father passed on, I don't think I learned anything new about Norman. And frankly, I like Psycho 2 and 3 just fine. That I really didn't think you need to skew the whole, you know, the two films that came prior to this one in order to make this one. I think this could have just as well have been a a legitimate sequel to Psycho 3.
And yeah, we can also
in the same place.
It's almost like sports where you have an asterisk for the NBA team that won when Jordan retired, and then you say, oh, that doesn't really count.
Yep.
So you could say maybe this one doesn't count per se because it's made for TV, but if you were to rate it as a made for TV movie, you'd probably bounce it up to 3. Mm. Who knows? But it's lows. The series lows are not that low.
No, you're
although
right.
Although its highs aren't that high either, but I mean,
I just remember when I being really underwhelmed the first time I saw this, and it could be that I was just gorging myself on anything and everything, including all the Italian stuff and all the, you know, the more lurid stuff. And so this one just kind of, it's okay. Did I enjoy a bit more on this viewing? Probably, but not to the point that I'm going to, you know, I might have given it 2 stars prior, now I'm going to up it to 2.5 stars. But as far as I'm concerned, Tony Perkins is always a 4-star actor, so...
Yes, and hopefully you'll continue to listen to our podcast every Friday, new episodes for your listening enjoyment, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.